You are listening to Dishin' and Swishin', the world of women's hoops, on HoopFeed.com.
Hey everybody, David Siegel on Dishin' and Swishin' on HoopFeed, and it is my pleasure to bring back onto the show one of the guests that is always welcome here, and I was just waiting for her to have the success that was expected all year, and that's Kim Barnes-Errico, the head coach of St. John's. Coach, welcome back to Dishin' and Swishin'.
Thank you, David. It's so great to be here.
Well, Coach, so all it took was becoming the winningest coach in St. John's history and ending a 99-game winning streak for you to be an instant sensation.
To get on your show. I've been trying all year to get on your show, so finally I'm able to do it. So I feel like I've finally accomplished something this season.
Well, I figure at least I've done more homework in talking to you than Francesa did.
I saw that tweet too.
Well, you know, if he had pronounced your name right every time, it really would have been helpful.
Yeah, well, it's great to be on, too. The media attention after the win has been tremendous for our university and for our program.
Well, you know, my daughter is a junior in high school and is actually looking at St. John's as a possible college. She wasn't alive the last time St. John's beat UConn. So before we talk about the team, why don't you talk for a second about how crazy it has been?
Like you said, I mean, just the national recognition that this kind of win brings to our program has been tremendous. We have been, probably been in every local as well as national paper in the last couple of days. We've been on ESPN. We've been on most of the sports websites around town. And, I've done a couple radio gigs the last couple of days. And it's just been very crazy but very positive for our program. And our girls have worked so hard that they're kind of deserving of this.
Well, you know, for many, the enduring picture of the game is going to be Janika taking that three-pointer and making it. But for me, it was the picture of you and holding your daughters and walking across the court after the game with that big smile on your face.
Yeah, you know, it's such a joy for me to be able to include them in everything that I do. I have three wonderful children, and if I didn't have such a great support staff here at St. John's University, from the administration down to my assistant coaches, you know, as well as my family, I probably wouldn't be able to do the job that I do here as well as raise three children. But I'm surrounded by some really great people, and that allows me to bring my family to most things and have them celebrate in the success as well.
Well, today, we're recording this today. We're on the day of the West Virginia game, so this is before whatever happens tonight. But going into tonight's game, you've won 7 of 8, 11 of 13. It's amazing what a little bit of health can do for a team, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been kind of a little bit of a crazy year. You know, we've had so much adversity and so many different injuries and so many obstacles to overcome this season. This has probably been the most difficult season for me coaching in terms of things that have happened to me personally or to players in the program or in terms of health. And you hear about different programs that suffered through those kind of years. And I've been fortunate that we've been very healthy the last couple of years. So this season hasn't been that way. But I feel fortunate right now to have everybody back going into the final week of the season, everybody healthy, everybody playing well, and we're really hitting our stride at the right time.
So at any point in the season, when you had all this going on with all the injuries and all, did you ever think you'd have a really legitimate shot going into the last week of the biggest season of being the number two seed going into the tournament?
No, not at all. Somebody had asked me that question yesterday because you just never know how people are going to respond to adversity and how people are going to respond to being out and to coming back off injuries. I mean, Deshina was, you know, probably hadn't picked up a basketball in over 4 months. You never know how your body's going to handle that, how you're going to handle it mentally, physically, and how your team's going to adjust to you after being out for such a long period of time. You know, we lost our point guard, who's a sensation. We lost her for a bunch of games. So, you know, you just never know how your team is going to respond. But I think the experience that they've had playing together and the upperclassmen that we have in the program, that once Deshina got healthy and got back, there was almost a sense of relief, like, okay, here we go. You know, we've held it together for so long. Now we're going to get this thing going. And then, you know, Nadira gets hurt in the Baylor game. So we had to go through a three-game stretch without our, you know, our point guard, and she's a special kid, a special player. So that really took a little bit of a toll. But once we've gotten her back, you know, our confidence is at a high. The kids are playing well together. You know, they're just really clicking, and it's nice to see. But no, I didn't think that, you know, we would ever get it back, you know, this quickly.
Well, you mentioned Deshina. Let's talk about her for a second. Deshina Stevens is one of the few seniors that are on the team, the Connecticut girl that got away, that made it into New York. And, you know, she's been a difference maker in the entire program, not just on the court right now. But she sort of changed the mentality a little bit, and, you know, things started to really pick up again when she entered the program.
Yeah, that's. I don't think a lot of people really understood that. If you haven't watched us play, and if you haven't watched our program over the last couple of years, Deshina Stevens just isn't the typical basketball player. I mean, she has been the face of our program for 4 years. Since the first day she stepped on campus, our program immediately turned around. The success that she's had over her 4-year career here has probably been on par with all of the great players and the great programs in the country. She came in, she was Big East Freshman of the Year, which is something no one at St. John's had done for many, many, many years. Then she was, you know, first team all-conference. She was invited to USA basketball tryouts. This is a special kid. It's not just your average basketball player. Coming into this year, she made a commitment to really lead our team and take on that role of being a leader because she really valued the importance of that going into her senior year. Then when we got the news about her knee, you know, it kind of felt like all of that was taken away and all of her hard work was taken away. And how were we going to kind of keep this thing together until she could get back? And, you know, she had some bumps in the road. She had some ups and downs. Obviously, emotionally, it was a very difficult time for her. But she hung in there, and she, you know, her teammates kept her going. She was very positive to be around. And since she's been back, she's just been unbelievable.
Yeah, the offense is starting to come around more and more. She's been scoring in double figures regularly now. But the thing that I always find interesting about her is, you know, she's a 6'1" forward, okay? She's not a big center. She's not a huge rebounder. She's not a huge shot blocker. But when she's in the lineup, the team holds opponents to 6 points less per game. She just, there's something about her out there that anchors the defense.
She, and that's what people didn't understand, like her first 3 games back, you know, some people came to see her play and they're like, oh, she's a shell of herself. I said, okay, you guys might think that right now because she's not scoring, but the presence that she has on the floor and the way she goes after the ball and the way she rebounds the basketball is something that we didn't have in our lineup. So even when she doesn't score, her experience on the defensive end is just brings, you know, another level to our team. And you know, with the 3 junior guards that we have that have been playing together with her for the last 3 years, when they play defense together, they're unbelievable. I mean, they have a ton of experience. They know what I expect. They know how to do it, and they just get it done, you know. We're working a freshman or a sophomore in at that 5th spot, and their responsibility is to help that kid along. But the 4 of them have played together for 3 years, and they can really get it done on the defensive end.
Hold on 1 second. I'll edit this out. Sorry, I had to move. My daughter turned on the television set in the room.
Okay. Hey, I know how that goes.
So I had to switch to another room. Okay. Well, then I was looking at the game notes for the West Virginia game, and it says next to Shanika Smith's name, made 3-point shot to beat win UConn game. That barely scratches the surface of Shanika Smith. I got a chuckle out of that. She's only the team's leading scorer, rebounder, and shot blocker, and it would be amazing what she could do if you guys would feed her.
Right. Exactly. She needs to gain about 25 pounds, and I keep telling her that for the last 3 years. All we're going to do in the off season is eat and lift weights.
Well, she certainly has been a difference maker in her career, and you know, she's at least been, you know, the thinnest one on the group is the one that's been on the court for most of the season compared to everybody else.
She, you know, and I think, you know, something that goes unnoticed about her that she does better than all those three things that you mentioned is she's our team's best defender. We put her on the best kid on the other team, and she has just done a tremendous job all year long of locking that kid up. The other night she got to guard Tiffany Hayes, and she, you know, probably held her to one of her season low in points. And, you know, another night she'll guard April Sykes, and another night she'll guard Shoni Schimmel. And it doesn't matter if it's the point guard, the one, the two, or the three. She uses her length, she uses her athleticism to get it done, and she's just been tremendous for us all year long on the defensive end, and I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize.
And then you've got the McBackcourt, which is fantastic, and I don't want to slight Ms. McPherson, but for the sake of time's sake, we'll just say that she's been one of the most consistent players on the team all season. But I do want to ask the question about how if they, when they announced the Lieberman Award finalists, how did Big East Player of the Week, Nadira McKenneth, not make that list?
You and I both have the same question. I guess, you know, not enough people have been watching college basketball because we have had the opportunity all year long to be on television. And, you know, we had the opportunity to play against Baylor where Nadira McKenneth was dominant in that game. She went down in the second half, but up until the point she went down with that injury, she was the best player on the court next to Brittany Griner. Then we had the opportunity to play on television against Rutgers, who has five McDonald's All-Americans, and Nadira McKenneth was the best player on the floor in both of those Rutgers games. You know, we played Louisville on television as well, and Nadira McKenneth, you know, did her job in that game as well. So I just don't understand. Every opponent that we play, whether it be Notre Dame, UConn, probably West Virginia, you know, say, hey, we got to get the ball out of this kid's hands. This kid controls this team. This kid is one of the best players on the floor. So I think other people know how great she is, and if you see her on film, you really appreciate the things she does for our team. So it's kind of funny that she's not being recognized at the national level. I think, you know, maybe people got to see her on tape a little bit or watch some of our games. And, you know, maybe it was due to us not being healthy and having the record that we had. But, you know, to be in third place in the Big East Conference, the best conference in the country, and, you know, beat Connecticut, play a great game with Notre Dame, and not have your point guard recognized was just kind of a little bit shocking to me.
Well, she clearly controlled that UConn game. Now, Coach, the last thing I just want to say to you is, you know, in Charlie Cream's latest bracketology, you're a 6 seed. He's got you going to Ames, Iowa to face Iowa State, and then congratulations, you get Notre Dame again. You know, what do you got to do to catch a break?
You know, it's funny because, you know, everybody talks about the NCAA tournament and where you're going to go, and you know, we have played really well in the NCAA tournament the last couple of years, but we haven't been fortunate because we've been on other teams' home court. So I said, you know, I don't care who we have to play. I hope we get to play on a neutral court because I think we have a chance against anybody, and I think we've kind of shown that if we have the opportunity to play on a neutral court. So I'm hoping that Charlie does a tremendous job. I know he does, and I appreciate his bracketology because we all look forward to checking it out every week. But I hope he's not correct. I hope he's a little bit off on this one, and I hope we get a little bit luckier than that.
Well, I wish you the best of luck as you wrap the regular season, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in Hartford in just about 2 weeks. And that should be a great Big East tournament with all of the teams that are going in there. We've got 8 teams that are potentially headed to the NCAA tournament out of the Big East, and it should be a lot of fun.
Thank you, David. It's always great to be on, and like you said, the Big East tournament should be tremendous. I think, you know, we've shown, the conference has shown that we got some of the best teams. You know, we're the deepest conference in the country, and we got some of the best teams in the country in our league. So it should be an exciting time, and I'm sorry I missed you at UConn, but I hope to see you up there in Hartford.
Well, you definitely will, and it's nice, always nice to talk to you. And I'm sure in some ways it was nice to not just talk about the UConn game today.
Yes, it was terrific, and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you, David.
Take care.
Hi, this is Muffet McGraw, head coach of the University of Notre Dame, and you're listening to Dishin' and Swishin'.
Hey, everybody. David Siegel hosting Dishin' and Swishin', the world of women's hoops on Hoop Feed each week. And we're going to throw together a quick roundtable for you right now. And I've got two people that have not been on the show in one ever and one in quite a while. And I'm pleased first to welcome back Basketball Times Wendy Parker. And also I'm pleased to welcome for the first time AP women's basketball writer Doug Feinberg. How are you both today?
Great, David. I really appreciate the invitation. I've been hearing great things about this for a while, and I'm glad I finally made the cut.
I want to start right away. We saw West Virginia knock off Notre Dame. We saw Connecticut get knocked off by St. John's. We saw Texas Tech fight with Baylor before they went down. Delaware's been top 10 and struggled. You know, and we've seen that magic word parity keeps coming up. And I want to bring up exactly what you guys think. Is there more parity going on out there, or is it just the fact that occasionally lightning strikes? Doug, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think it's occasionally lightning strikes. Not take away anything away from West Virginia's victory or St. John's victory. I think at some point everything's going to end. I mean, UConn is not going to go the rest of the history of women's basketball winning at home and never losing again. I think that there's a lot of good talent out there, but I think it takes a lot more than a couple wins to say parity is out there. I think St. John's win the other day was phenomenal. They played a great game. I think Gino said himself it was a perfect storm for them to win, and it really was. And they've been playing phenomenal. I know you just talked to Kim, I think, and it was just a perfect storm for them to come out and end UConn's 99-game winning streak at home, the 261-ranked streak at home, and just so many streaks. But it was impressive, and there's a lot more talent out there, and I think there's a chance for teams to knock some other teams off, but I'm not sure that come 3 weeks from now we're in the NCAA tournament, you're going to see anything other than the top few teams playing for the national championship.
Wendy, what do you think?
I think it's a little bit of that. You know, when we've talked about parity in women's basketball for years, and people want it so much because they see the same teams in the Final Four playing for the national championship every year. It's like it's this desire, this great desire to have parity. So you get really excited when you see UConn lose for the first time in 99 games at home. But sometimes parity isn't always a good thing. I mean, I think there are some really good teams out there. You know, Baylor, even though Baylor had a close call the other day with Texas Tech, they still, to me, are head and shoulders, you know, the best team in the country. But, you know, UConn isn't probably as strong as they've been. Tennessee has struggled. You know, Notre Dame has shown a little bit of, you know, some the last couple of weeks as maybe they did earlier. Maybe some of those teams aren't as good as we thought they would be or that they perhaps had been in the past. So, you know, sometimes parity is a matter of some of those top teams coming down a little bit to the rest of the field or at least to the next tier. But you're seeing teams like Maryland and Miami here in the ACC, you know, Kentucky rising up. So it might be a little bit of some of those things happening as well. But, you know, parity is great to talk about in the middle of February, but I want to see where we're going to be with all this in a month from now.
Well, on a similar subject to that then, you know, right now in the latest bracketology that Charlie Cream has come out, Delaware is sitting as a 3 seed, Green Bay is there as a 5, and St. Bonaventure also is a 5. Are there any mid-majors that can really compete with the big boys? ESPN had an article today on the men's side saying stop calling them mid-majors and just start realizing that they're all contenders for a national title. I don't think it's that way at all on the women's side.
You know, Delaware and St. Bonaventure, the two examples you just named, I mean, they're going to be kind of new to all this, at least being in such, you know, lofty territory. I mean, this will be St. Bonaventure's first trip to the final, to the NCAA tournament. So it'll be really interesting to see how they respond to that. I mean, Green Bay's been around for a while. You know, Gonzaga obviously is coming off a good run. I just don't think the mid-majors, as we refer to them, you know, they haven't had the developed tournament history on the women's side that we've been seeing on the men's side for a number of years. It's still a little bit, you know, behind the curve, as it were.
Well, I think if you look at this, I'm sorry, David.
If you
look at this men's side, you had VCU making that unbelievable run last year that they were, what, a couple shots away from making the national championship game and potentially winning this whole thing. And Butler the last couple of years has been unbelievable. And those are two awesome stories. And I think there are a few on the women's side. I mean, St. Bonnie's has been great. Wisconsin Green Bay, for the last, as Wendy said, few years, has been a consistent contender playing awesome defense and their own style. And now you have the greatest story in women's basketball that no one's ever going to see in Delaware until the NCAA tournament. I mean, there's no doubt Elena Deladon is the second-best player in college basketball right now. I've seen her play probably a half dozen times. She, in her worst game of her career on Sunday, was 3-for-18 from the field, and there's 15 seconds left. They're down one, and everyone in the gym knew where the ball was going, and Drexel had three girls on her, and they couldn't stop her from hitting a game left, 2 seconds left. So there is talent. I mean, I know Jackie Stiles is the go-to girl and the sort of what everyone compares mid-major stars to. And Courtney Vandersloot was great the last couple years for Gonzaga and got them as far as they've ever gone, although it did help they played in the home area. I think Deladon can do the same thing for Delaware. I mean, she is that good. She can change a game just by her presence. She's so tough to play against. I mean, she's 6'5" with guard skills. So I've talked to a few coaches, and I'm not really sure how you can guard her. You put a big on her, she'll drive by them. You put a guard on her, she'll post them up. So that they have that star quality, that star power. Are they going to make a Final Four run? Probably not. But they might make some noise and upset some teams in the tournament that wouldn't expect to lose to Delaware.
Well, you actually fed me into two different topics that I'd like to bring up. And since you mentioned Deladon as the second best player, we might as well talk player of the year for a minute here as an interlude. I personally think that player of the year is Brittany Griner, with no disrespect to Deladon, Nneka Ogwumike, Skylar Diggins, whoever you want to talk about. You know, I think that Griner, in my opinion, Baylor doesn't get her involved enough. And she's still a dominant presence on both ends of the court now. To me, it's not even much of a discussion, even though the others are certainly having incredible seasons and are incredible talents. Doug, do you agree with that assessment?
Well, David, I think you made a really good point there when you said she affects the game on both ends of the floor. And that's something that Nneka, Elena, and Skylar, the other three potential players of the year, don't do. They're great players. They're great to watch. They're fun to watch. But teams don't game plan their offense on how to score because of those three players. Whereas every team that plays against Baylor tries to figure out a way to score or a way to avoid getting their shot blocked a zillion times because of her. And I think you're right. They don't get her the ball enough. She doesn't probably could average 35 a game if they got her the ball as many touches as I'm sure that Kim would like. But she just is such an impact player on both ends of the floor that we've never seen in women's basketball at any level that's what makes her the player of the year. I mean, best player on best team usually tends to win these things. And she's only a junior, and they're all only juniors except for Nneka. I mean, she is something special to watch.
Wendy?
It's hard to argue against Brittany Griner. Obviously, I think watching Baylor, too, seeing the other players emerge, Odyssey, Sims, the rest of that supporting cast there, they've all kind of grown together. They were, you know, freshmen, some of them, not or even still in high school when they got to the Final Four a couple of years ago. So I think it's I'm not going to say that it's making Griner's job easier because she's always getting double and triple team, but she's thriving in an atmosphere where there's so many other good players around her who are also affecting the game. Just the way Odyssey Sims plays defense out in the perimeter is really something that kind of tends to get overlooked, but it's really hard to go against Griner. I couldn't imagine voting for anybody else this year, even despite the great season that Deladon's had.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned was the run that Courtney Vandersloot had, and it was almost all done close to home. And that's one of the things, Charlie Cream's bracketology we've been talking about a little bit. I was looking at the one that came out today, and one of the things that really jumped out at me is the fact that a couple of the upstart teams that are doing so well may end up on the road in extremely hostile areas. St. John's, for example, could end up at Ames, Iowa against Iowa State. And in one of the ones that could be a dreaded matchup, since everybody wants to see her go far, Deladon and Delaware could end up in Spokane against Gonzaga. This is becoming more and more of a problem. Doug, when is the NCAA going to do something about this?
I'm not really sure they can right now. I don't think the game's grown big enough that they can have neutral sites to house it enough that they get the fans out there to actually make it a financially responsible idea. It's unfortunate. I mean, look, it was great TV last year having Gonzaga play close to home and make that incredible run. I mean, that was wonderful for ratings, and it was great for the area, and it's great for Gonzaga. And I think, Wendy, you probably agree, it's great for the game having other teams get out there. But it is unfortunate. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago I was at Rutgers when they were, I think, a 7 seed or maybe even a 10 seed, and Auburn came to town as the 2 and had to play them in the second round of the NCAA tournament and just got destroyed by them. And was it fair to Auburn to have to play a 10 seed or 7 seed on their home court when they were the much higher seed? But that said, coaches have said, you know what, if we can't win on the road in the NCAA tournament, no matter where we're playing, we probably don't deserve that high seed to begin with. So I'm not sure, David, that there really is a way the NCAA can fix it right now. I think in Charlie's bracket, 13 of the 16 sites had host seeds, and it was causing issues as far as a host team, sorry, that were going to cause issues as far as seeding goes and putting a lot of ones and twos and threes on hostile courts. But I'll go with the coaches. They know the best. They should be able to win games on the road if they're really that good. Baylor should be able to go into Iowa and win a game there if they need to. Or Auburn shouldn't be able to knock off Rutgers at home if they need to.
Right. And
Wendy, is it a cop-out when the coaches say that because they have to?
I think so, but I think the way that we compare the women's tournament and the men's, you know, where the men play at mostly neutral sites, although, you know, when you see a sub-regional in the men's tournament in Charlotte or Greensboro, invariably Duke or North Carolina are going to be there. And I think I might have mentioned this on another podcast somewhere else. You know, you look at all the other college sports, including baseball, and they've got, you know, home teams, you know, the higher-seeded teams playing at home almost throughout. You've got the regionals, and then you've got super regionals. I think that the rest of the non-revenue college athletic hierarchy is all that, you know, they don't seem to get all worried about it. I think there's this expression of desire in the women's game to try to have it as neutral and balanced as possible, and it just isn't there because of attendance. And if they could find some kind of a method where you know you're going to get better attendance early on, maybe that's a little bit different from this, something between this and maybe the regional, super regional system that you see in college baseball and college softball, that sort of thing. But I was never really a fan of the system that they have now because I thought it did punish the better teams who played better during the season. And now we're seeing some more mid-majors that under the old system would probably be playing at home instead of, you know, Delaware having to go on the road this season. But, yeah, I do think if you're a top four seed, you ought to be able to win on, and you can't win on the road, and you were winning on the road during the regular season, I don't know how you would explain that. I just don't really see a better way right now unless they just, you know, throw up their hands and say, listen, we can't make this move toward neutrality that we'd like to, that maybe, you know, we have to acknowledge that it's never going to be quite the way we want it to be. We're never going to get the crowds unless we can, you know, create these kinds of atmospheres that we're trying to create in early rounds.
You know, one of the things that I can never understand is, you know, what makes them decide, you know, where to put some of these regionals in the first place? Because I'd like to know what that hotbed of women's basketball, Kingston, Rhode Island, has done to deserve to host a regional.
Well, David, it depends on who bids, and I've always the question I've always had for people on the committee is: are you getting enough schools, enough, you know, places, you know, cities, and that sort of thing that have arenas? Are you getting enough places to bid? And they say that they are, and I think they want to bring it to new venues like Kingston, so I think their hands are tied by how many people put the bids. Those schools and those cities have to put up a financial guarantee too, and if they're only going to see 1,000 or 2 people in their arena, they may be reluctant to bid. So they're kind of limited by that as well.
I mean, you look at a place like Kingston, and it's almost like they said, "Well, we know we're going to get the Connecticut people, so we'll put in the bid for it, and then they get awarded it because they'll get the Connecticut people." Well, why put it in Rhode Island then? Why not put it in Massachusetts or someplace else in Connecticut?
Yeah.
Well, also, I mean, what if Connecticut loses? God forbid. I mean, that's going to make for a probably pretty quiet arena up there in Kingston, I would think.
Right.
I think that it would be very quiet.
Right. I mean, I think it just depends on who bids for it, and you see the same, you know, the same usual suspects. You know, those are the schools or cities that seem to be committed to it more than others, or that end up. But they had a first and second round venue here in the Atlanta area, halfway between Athens and Atlanta, a couple of years ago. It's a nice neutral floor. They had the SEC women's tournament there, but in Georgia was playing in it, and they, you know, didn't get but a couple thousand. And Georgia was the host for that, and I don't know if they bid for anything else again, but a lot of it depends on the willingness of these schools. Again, they've got to put up a financial guarantee to do it, and, you know, you're going to see, you know, that, I mean, the powerhouse schools, the usual schools that we're seeing here that are going to be hosting again, and there's not a lot of variation. Kingston's, I think, the only one that hasn't done it before, if I'm not mistaken, so...
I don't want to seem like a Delaware apologist, but I'll tell you right now, I'll go on record, David, and you can come back next year at this time or a couple weeks after and say you were right or you were completely wrong. 2013, Delaware's hosting the first two rounds, and I think that's going to be one of the best sites, if not the best site, in the first two rounds next year, because that place holds like 4,000 people, and it gets rocking when it's crowded. And with Deladon coming back next year, that place is going to be sold out way in advance of the first two rounds. They'll make the tournament again, and I think it's going to be great for people who haven't seen it and haven't been there, but like, wow, this is a great venue for women's basketball. And we've been up to Connecticut many times when they've hosted the tournament, and it's not that loud an arena because their fans are used to it. They expect them to win. It's like, we know they're going to win the first round by 60 points, so why am I going to go out and pay my money to go see it? Whereas new places like Delaware and maybe Kingston, although, again, who knows with who's going to actually be up there, that maybe they get some more people. I mean, how great was Spokane last year? And they got another regional again next year. It's just one of those places that likes women's basketball and can be loud. And it's not a 20,000-seat arena. It's smaller, that maybe you get those fans who want to come there and make you actually have that feel of like, wow, I'm playing in a big game in a big arena.
Right.
Well, one thing that I did hear from somebody that participated in the mock bracket, the mock selection. Doug, you went to that, didn't you?
I was actually the first two. I was not at this one, but it's a phenomenal time. And it lets you actually, you get such a behind-the-scenes look at how they do the selection process, and they just demystify it. And just anyone who has any notions about what they thought going in, how the committee decides stuff, it completely blows your mind as far as what they really do. And it gives you a much better appreciation for how hard these committee members work.
Well, I did hear that there is at least a very strong rumor that size of arena is going to be removed from the equation as they go forward for early round selections. So some of these smaller schools, not even smaller gyms than Delaware's possibly, could put in for first and second round games and get them going forward, as opposed to, you know, them committing to only the, you know, Bridgeport, Notre Dame, Ames, you know, and all these other school places that still get it.
And isn't that better for everybody if you have, like...
Yeah.
Agreed.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see what kind of crowd they get over at Bowling Green, too. They're hosting in the early rounds this year, too. So, you know, maybe we're getting more mid-majors who are who are hosting, and I think that's a good thing, too, that, you know, if you get more schools like that that they want to be involved in it, I think you can create a better atmosphere, make it a tougher ticket like it probably will be at Delaware next year, and like it has been in Spokane.
Changing subjects a little bit here. Wendy, you being the Southerner here, you know, the SEC, are they worthy of eight teams in the tournament? Like, it's, you know, this is supposedly another quote-unquote down year for the conference, yet they're sitting there and, you know, everybody's raving right now about the Big East and you know, how strong because of the upsets with West Virginia and St. John's, but the SEC in the current selection has the same amount of teams in as the Big East, and that's at eight.
I mean, it looks like they're going to get seven. Florida would be the eighth team, and they got a really good win on Sunday against Georgia. They have come so close to beating really good teams. They lost in overtime to Vanderbilt, which when it went to overtime on a miracle three-point shot. So Florida got they finally got that good win. They're 17-10 and 7-7, and that's you know, pretty good. Their RPI is in the 30s. So unless they have a really bad loss here, or, you know, get knocked out in the first round of the SEC tournament, I think they might be able to get in. It just depends on, you know, if you've got some of these conferences that may get a second or third team, you know, beyond their regular winner, you know, some of the mid-majors that look like they could get an at-large team or two. That's only one win for them, and I think they might need to do a little bit more to stand a better chance. And if they can, you know, keep that momentum, because that was really a very, very good win for them. They finish out against Mississippi State and Tennessee in their regular seasons and before the SEC tournament. So they took a big step toward being that eighth team, but as of this moment, I'm not sure they're quite that team yet. They might need to do a little bit more work.
Hey, Doug, did you think in recent memory you'd see the Big Ten with as many teams as the Big 12?
You know, coming off the last couple of years, everyone's saying the Big Ten was down and they're not really good anymore. The kids all are leaving the Midwest. But they've been pretty exciting this year. I mean, Penn State with a huge win over Ohio State last night to clinch at least a share of the title of the conference. I mean, Penn State, Ohio State, Michigan's been playing really well. Michigan State's been playing pretty well. Iowa's been playing well. I mean, there's a bunch of teams in there. The Big 12, I think, graduated a fair amount of kids who were pretty talented last year, or else they've had a couple of kids hurt by ACL injuries or other injuries, and it's really been Baylor and then everybody else, obviously, because, I mean, they're that good. It would be surprising if I think you have an equal number, if not more, Big 10 teams than Big 12, just because the conference RPI is up there. But, yeah, I was shocked when I saw Charlie's bracketology this morning, and he does a phenomenal job. But I think just going every week, I kind of eyeball myself looking at just the conference standings, who could be in. I'm struggling to get 64 teams. And again, as Wendy said, that doesn't count for upsets in mid-major tournaments and such, or for some of the big tournaments, the big Power Six. But this isn't a good year. Like, there aren't that many teams out there that we don't know about. They're like, wow, this team really deserves to get in. And that's like, I came up with, like, I think 66 right now. And then again, that's, to me, a low number to have for this point in the year. Usually I think it's like in the 70, 75 range to actually make the NCAA tournament. So I think there might be in a down year across the boards in a sense.
And this has been the case for the last two or three years, because I did the mock bracket a couple of years ago, and we were reaching for teams. And, you know, you're wondering, well, if we're having trouble doing it, you know, the committee is going to have trouble doing it. And you look at, and I think Charlie does a great job too, but, man, it's getting tougher and tougher for anybody to make a case why North Carolina should be in there, the fact that you're looking for teams. I mean, I just, you know, they just, you know, there are some teams that you just kind of shake your head at. But in a better year, you know, in a stronger year, you know, you'd be, you know, sliding off that bubble. And yet you look around and you say, okay, if you're going to take out North Carolina, who else are you going to put in there? I mean, they've got the right win numbers overall and in their conference, but their RPI and their strength of schedule is terrible, and it's, you know, you just wonder what you have to do to find somebody else or to find some other schools out there, and it's really a reach. It's for like the third or fourth year in a row.
Could you imagine if they expanded to 96 teams right now? What we'd be looking at making this tournament?
There's no way they can do that. There's no. I mean, I just don't think that that's going to – I can't see that that's going to happen. I mean, if the men aren't going to do it, I can't see how the women are going to do it. I don't know what the justification or the rationale would be for that. I know they've been talking about doing it, but I know Marilyn McNeil, the last year's committee chairwoman, talked about that at the Final Four last year. But I don't know where it stands this year, but I don't know, you know, how you would – that's more of an expense that you know involved in that, and where would you find the teams? And you know, you'd have teams, a lot of teams with really well sub 500 conference records that would be really hard to take in, I think.
I can't see that happening at all. I don't even want to think about that.
No. Happening. I would hope that's I hope that's nowhere on the front burner.
Well, I don't want to keep you guys much longer. I want to ask you each one more question, and then, you know, we'll let you go, because I appreciate your time, and I know you both have a lot of things that you're trying to work on. one thing this season that has caught you off guard that's been the biggest surprise to you this season? Wendy, we'll start with you.
The biggest surprise, I think, is just that there's this one overwhelming favorite in Baylor and not too many others right there. I mean, I think, you know, Notre Dame probably has the capability, maybe UConn or Tennessee, Stanford, that we're, you know, we're talking a lot about parity, but there's this one, you know, the big name out there that seems to be the one favorite, and it's not the one that we're used to hearing from, although Baylor's been good for many years. To me, that's the thing. I thought that would be a little bit stronger at the top than it has been. It still is pretty strong, but you know, I think it's going to be hard to bet against Baylor when the tournament starts.
And Doug?
I don't know if it's the biggest surprise or not, but I got to say that the pressure that Tennessee must have been feeling this year, the players, coming in, they were one of the top five teams in the country, and they've lost some games on the road they probably shouldn't have. And I can only imagine how much pressure those kids must have felt coming into the year, having not wanting to be the first senior class to not make a Final Four in Tennessee's history, and then throw in the Pat Summit Alzheimer, and how much more pressure they must feel to try to win for her, and how they've been sort of struggling at times, and they haven't looked good at times on the defensive end, and just on the road they've really struggled. But then you see the last week when they blew out Kentucky by 40 at home, which I don't think anyone would have predicted going into that game. So that to me is the biggest surprise. And again, surprise may not be the best word, more like shock or sadness or just unexplainable thing, how Tennessee has been this up-and-down team where we talk about powers, and Wendy, you said that they're Baylor being the overwhelming favorite is a little bit of a surprise, that a team that's been that overwhelming favorite for so many years over the last 25 or so or 30 is Tennessee, and how they've been one of these teams that's been up or down, and you never know what you're going to get from them. And hopefully in the next 3 weeks when the NCAA tournament comes around, they're not one of the teams we're saying, wow, I can't believe they lost in the first and second round.
Right. Well, I mean, they did beat Mississippi State and Ole Miss on the road last week as well, but they didn't really look all that good either. It's like they had that great game against Kentucky, but they just haven't been that consistently good from game to game. And it's, you know, they let Ole Miss back in the game for a while there in the second half before closing it out. And it's, you know, it's, you're right. I can't imagine what it's like. You know, they've got all this talent and they've got the distraction of not knowing what the situation is going to be like, you know, with their coach. And it's just, it's really tough to watch that when you've seen Tennessee for so many years and it's just really struggle to get through games that they normally wouldn't have much trouble winning.
Now, the other thing about that whole situation that struck me as a little bit odd as somebody that's, you know, looking at it a bit from afar. I mean, I've never had a real, horse in the race, even being up here in Connecticut. You know, I've always had tremendous respect for the program and for Coach Summit. You know, here, you look at a team like St. John's, and it took them until January 1st before they got healthy. And look where they are now. They're on a roll heading into the tournament. You know, Tennessee has had lost games from almost everybody. You know, Strickland was hurt for a little bit. Johnson's had this recurring shoulder. Spaney missed a whole bunch of games with, and I consider her to really be part of the heart of that team. Massimil was hurt. You know, yet every time they would struggle, it was, oh, what's up with Pat? You know, it was never, you know, gee, these guys have a lot of injuries. Yeah, so I think that further added a little bit even more pressure because, you know, nobody ever gave them a little bit of a break for being injured.
Yeah, right. Well, the other thing, but it's really hard to get out from under that shadow, you know, the uncertainty about the future of the program. And they, one of the top high school players in the country who has a verbal to Tennessee a couple of years ago, a young lady from here in Georgia named Taylor Davis, she's reopened her commitment. And that, you know, on the recruiting trail, that's a really big signal. And so I think that just kind of increases, you know, everything that's going on there, I guess the uncertainty of it. So, obviously they're playing through a lot this year, but this is a really experienced team, too, and I think they've got enough talent to get to the Final Four, but they just haven't really looked like they've been that kind of a team on a consistent enough basis. That's what it looks like from here anyway.
Yeah, Doug, I know I said one, that was my last question, but I do have one more that I wanted to ask you about. Having been a part of that mock selection exercise, well, you did it too, right, in the past?
Mm-hmm.
One question I've always had is I've seen in the men's side, it seems that they definitely upgrade or downgrade a team based on injuries and how the team is at that time. Specifically, I remember Cincinnati with Kenyon Martin.
Yep.
Getting injured and not being a number one seed. You look at a team like Duke, who still has a lot of talent, but they have been decimated lately, and they're down so much to so many people now. Will the committee move them up or move them down a line because of the injuries?
Well, I think they definitely can. And it's, again, about the information they have. They know every injury situation, when kids are coming back, who's not coming back. So they have all the information they need. My feeling is there's still, three games or so left in the regular season plus the ACC tournament, that they'll have a better idea of where Duke stands right now as far as the rest of the country goes by the time they have to actually make the selections. If I remember correctly, Kenyon Martin was hurt right at the end of the year. There wasn't time to figure out where Cincinnati is going to fit in from that standpoint. I mean, I think that they'll probably put Duke where they deserve to be, which right now is probably a two seed, maybe a three if things really fall apart for them. But they do a really good job as far as knowing who's playing well, who's not playing well, who can play and who's hurt, that they'll put them in the right spot as far as their team they will be able to put on the floor for the first round of the NCAA tournament come March 17th or 18th.
And they also will see how a team plays without a player, if there's enough time to gauge how that team has done. And obviously Duke had a tough time without Rishay Jackson, losing to Maryland on Sunday, but they've got a few more games to show what they can do without her, and they're down to just a handful of players. But depending on how long that player is out, like Miami, one of Miami's starters, Morgan Stroman, she's out too for the year, but they've had a little bit more time to adapt to that. So depending on how well they finish and what they do in their ACC tournament, sometimes if a team shows that they can play, that they're okay without that player who's hurt, maybe it doesn't hurt them, but a lot of it just depends on the timing of the injury.
It's funny, David, you mentioned Duke, because I'm actually going down there tomorrow. There's the joy of women's basketball and of Duke is they're nice enough to put on a media game every year, a basketball game, and I'm actually going down to play in Cameron on Wednesday afternoon with a bunch of other media folks from the area. So there won't be the crazies going nuts on us, but it's a good experience, and hopefully I get to talk to Coach P for a little bit and to the players and see where they mentally are after. I mean, they lost by two to Maryland, I think, on Sunday in a really good game. So we'll see if they've recovered mentally and are ready for the rest of their season where they could still win the ACC.
So you're going to drop a couple of dimes, or are you get the ball and become a black hole, Doug?
I like to get my teammates involved. If I had to compare my game to somebody right now, couldn't even tell you who it was. It's been a while since I've been on the court in a serious manner, but yeah, I like to get everyone involved with my teammates.
Okay, and as the way we like to end these roundtables is by giving you one last chance to say where anybody can find anything that you're doing or writing. And also end with any type of thought that you would like to share with the listeners. So, Wendy, why don't we start with you? We'll give the newcomer a chance to think about it for a second.
Well, I write a monthly column in Basketball Times, which is the last vestige of print that I still am involved with as a journalist. My homepage is wendyparker.org, and I link to some of my stuff on there. My last thought is I think we are going to see a few surprises in the NCAA tournament. Maybe not at the end, but it's been really nice to see some things happen, at least at the regional level that might have shown that there is. I think parity is emerging, but it's still not quite here yet, and maybe this year will be another step in that direction. But It's fun to see a lot of different names and surprising names, you know, be in the fray. And, you know, if they're not all in Denver, then, you know, that's so be it. But it's kind of fun to have a lot to be excited about during the regular season. It's hard to believe it's almost over with. It's only a couple more games left before we get to March. So the season's flown by, but it's been a lot of fun to watch a lot of exciting things happen.
Doug?
It's actually a good question, David. I don't really the joy of the AP is I don't know where the stuff goes. We always joke that AP stands for all papers because that's potentially anyone could be picking up the stories I write. So I don't have a great answer as far as where you could find my stuff per se, but it's usually out there. And
I can answer it better for you.
Okay.
Everything Doug writes is to follow his Twitter feed.
Yes, the Doug Feinberg Twitter feed. Definitely, you can find my stuff there pretty easily. As far as, like, things I'm excited for, I look at it this way. This past weekend, I got the pleasure of seeing one of the most exciting games of the year up in UConn with St. John's ending that UConn streak. And then about, I don't know, 20 hours later, 15 hours later, I was down in Philadelphia watching Drexel almost upset number 9 Delaware in one of the other most exciting games of the year. And I get paid to do that. So I get the pleasure of going out and actually watching really exciting games sometimes, and I get paid to do it. And I can't think there's a better job that I can think of in this world than going out and doing what you love, covering what you love, and getting paid well to do it.
Well, you know, that's a tough act to follow. But, you know, one thing that I'm going to end it with, my thought is, I know conference realignment is about football. But just for one second, I want people to think about women's basketball and conference realignment. You know, the Big 12, how would Big 12 be looking with Nebraska instead of the Big 10 this year? The Big East is losing West Virginia, and that's going to be good for the Big 12, but the Big 12 is losing Texas A&M, and that's going to be great for the SEC. And the Big East is losing Pitt and Syracuse, and that doesn't really much matter to anybody. Except the ACC, who, congratulations, you can have Pitt and Syracuse. So it's interesting to me the byproduct of this conference realignment and seeing where these different schools are going to end up and what kind of effect it's going to have on the women's basketball landscape. Wendy and Doug, I want to thank you both for your time, and I hope that the rest of the season goes as well as everything else has this year, and that you guys continue in good health and enjoying all the games.
Thank you.
Thank you, pal.
And, you know, Doug, I got to admit, you may be the first person that's come up to me and said, so when do I get on the show? I appreciate your encouragement and support, and Wendy's been there from the beginning, and I couldn't do this without people like her. So thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. I'll see you soon.